Seven, eight, nine, 10, side two, yes. Now with some time to gather yourself for that answer.
I think the group that was large, at least in my mind, within IVS, although there were many different groups and they probably, well, you've talked to them, so they did fit into those other first two groups you mentioned. But I think your characterization of that third group is sort of wanting the communists to take over so that the war would end. Phrasing it that way may be somewhat a sort of retrospective look, because we know what happened.
Well, not yes, that's a good point.
Remember, there seemed to be more possibilities than that. Mm-hmm. When a lot of the Vietnamese that I knew didn't like the Saigon government because it was corrupt, inefficient, but they didn't like many people in Hue did not want to live under the communists. Mm-hmm. And there was, the problem was there was all this hope for some sort of third force, which was a kind of myth and a mirage. And because if you registered any displeasure with the Saigon regime, then you would be thrown in jail as a communist sympathizer. So there was no middle ground. That's what was so sad. But I think we often used to say, gee, if we could just, a lot of this is just, what would be the quality of life be under a communist regime, as opposed to the way it would be under some other, a sort of Saigon regime. And it was no clear answer to that. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of us were not necessarily confident that it would be better under a communist regime. Mm-hmm. So we didn't leap to that.
No,
let's
in fact,
end the war.
I didn't mean to suggest that. It was a question of the ultimate point about joining the anti-war movement was it would bring the war, American involvement to the war, of the war to an end. And what, in retrospect, is easy to say is, but if America isn't supporting this regime, knowing the way you know it from the inside, it might lead to a communist victory. And what you've said is something that it wasn't so clear in retrospect.
Yeah.
That the U.S. not continuing the war may have led to other outcomes, not necessarily the fall of Saigon, which no one expected, actually.
Yes.
No one in Vietnam
expected
to happen that rapidly.
There was still hope, at least there would be some sort of, even right toward the end, mm-hmm. although it was probably at that point with the Paris peace talks, as soon as they allowed the North Vietnamese troops to stay in place, mm-hmm. anyone with any, even someone like myself, with not only a moderate amount of sort of military political savvy could realize that wasn't going to work. But I mean, even right up until the end of that, I mean, there was some hope for some sort of coalition government. You remember that the Easter Offensive, which is the part of the war that I know, I mean, was most dramatic for me because I was in Hue that spring, the summer of red fire, as Phan Nhat Nam, the Vietnamese paratrooper journalist, calls it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that was the summer that, in terms of sort of the military effects on my friends and on me and on my wife, youngest, that was basically with a lot of American firepower and American advisors, but that was, the Vietnamese won in a sense. At least one in the sense of Ang Lập did not fall, They did take Quang Tri, but they recaptured it. Mm-hmm. Kon Tum in the Central Highlands did not go under, although it was threatened. I mean, in other words, that tremendous offensive, the biggest of the war, was turned back. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't this sense that, there wasn't this sense that all was lost. And that, and not necessarily that was good, because we did want the war to end. Mm-hmm. But I think many of us, I mean, I certainly felt that this war is just, the effect on the social fabric of Vietnam is terrible. And I couldn't see that we had any, in terms of America's own self-interest, that we had any great political or military need or interest that it was worth all this loss in life.
But the domino theory. You look at Vietnam today and you say, but we stopped communism. It didn't spread into the rest of Southeast Asia. So their philosophical conundrum, it must have been worth something, because they didn't win.
Yeah.
I mean, there are answers to that, clearly.
Yeah. I think it's... There was within IVS, and I think to a certain extent, I was a victim, you know, I tended to do it, is to romanticize the other side, mm-hmm. the liberation fighters. A good sort of antidote to that, I think, is to read some of the accounts of re-education camps. Mm-hmm. that, of course, often the guards seem to be of those camps seem almost as much victims as the prisoners, the detainees, mm-hmm. but in many ways, but you get if you want a terrible portrait of what a system like that leads to, mm-hmm. I think there was this romanticization of the revolutionists, the news right after, you know, I mean, the terrible economic, their inability to do anything economically right after the war ended, you know, gives one pause to...
Bounding, the sorrow of war.
Yes.
Had a chance to do
it
because
yes.
there, some of those fighters were worth romanticizing about in the sense that they could, there were also men of honor there. Just
yes,
as in Arvin,
absolutely,
there were men of
absolutely.
Honor.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. I taught mm-hmm. the sadness of war to mm-hmm. my students this spring. What you also get in that book is the kind of thing of how the pressure for a particular point of view is sort of taken a lot of the romance out of life, and a lot of that book I think is kind of a aspects of the Vietnamese soul and sensibility that a communist regime has kind of wiped away and made impossible, the sort of wild art of his father, mm-hmm. Which no one appreciates, mm-hmm. and that Phuong, his fiancée, kind of does appreciate. Great book. It's a great book.
Yeah, for some reason, I suppose, mm-hmm. but you know, to me, it seems that societies at war like that. That the only off to war, he goes off to war with an utter conviction. You know, that
yes.
he's fighting for his
yeah.
country, and she goes with him
mm-hmm.
to see him off. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she believes in it too. They're just mm-hmm. school kids.
Yeah.
And then later, of course, when he comes back, and there doesn't seem, you know, she's been destroyed by the war.
Yeah.
The idea is his liberation. She sees
mm-hmm.
the chaos as good.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, a government that's just defeated the most powerful country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
is full of confidence that its new autocratic
mm-hmm.
system is going to run really well.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, those destroyed by that same system in war, that
mm-hmm.
is, are
mm-hmm.
the best. And she is too, I mean, to
mm-hmm.
a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
And but she's out, and he can't,
mm-hmm.
except he does, through the chaos of his writing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know,
yes.
just like his father's art.
Yeah.
He becomes his father.
That's
his,
right. That's
his
right.
Own way.
That.
He writes
a little later after Doi Moi and
yes.
renovation and
yes.
that kind of thing
and
could reach the light of land.
yeah.
But a lot of the old guard
yeah.
didn't like that book
no.
and criticized it
mm-hmm.
for too much about this sort of too much about the sorrow of war and not enough about the glorious victories.
Oh yes, the glorious victory.
The glorious victory.
Uh-huh.
But yes, I think it's a very powerful
book. Of the line where he says. He's talking about a relatively prosperous country, actually,
mm-hmm.
and but he's still saying, is this our own
mm-hmm.
stupid economic policies?
Mm-hmm.
And we go bank, some of our villages go bankrupt, and others become millionaires,
mm-hmm.
and we're doing it to ourselves now,
mm-hmm.
but it's ours.
Yes.
So that's what we were fighting for. It's not ideology. It's for this freedom
right.
to destroy your own country, I suppose. But anyway, it's interesting to, now that we're getting enough stuff to throw into the hopper to try to source it out. But when you were in Getting Back, now I'm hoping that The Sadness of War, it's the paperback version now, is what it is, I mean, in Vietnamese. But I think hopefully it really says except to us, you know,
yeah.
like that. So it's going to be interesting. By the way.
Oh, did you?
AAS regional. Yeah, that and I'm trying to remember. It was two. Oh, it was Bui Tin's following Ho Chi Minh. And looking at looking how both
kiss and tell kind of book by book.
But still by a true believer.
By a true believer.
And Robert Dornan went after him, you know, saying he still thinks Ho is good, as if Ho has to be bad if communism in Vietnam is ineffectual. Those two things. It's like George Washington. We all know one of the great comments about George Washington was, you know, he wanted all those Whiskey Rebellion people to be hung because we have the new order now, and there aren't, you know, you're not allowed to grow your own whiskey and trade it. Now you got to pay taxes, you know, that. And Dornan doesn't realize that he's perpetuating this. Of course, you can love your leader and the ideals of the movement and be frustrated with its outcome.
Sure.
Well, everyone is.
Yeah.
That's a terrible movie, but Al Pacino's 1776.
I don't know.
That's a terrible movie, but you know, in the end, the veterans who have defeated the British have nothing.
Yeah.
You know, the elites that wage the war get the freedom to continue to not pay British taxes.
Sure.
And for everyone else, there's nothing. The wounded soldiers get nothing. They're homeless. They have no food.
Yeah.
The gap between the rich and the poor just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah.
And so what's the difference? Why is this unusual?
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, there's a lot of ideology riding on the outcome of the Vietnam War. If you don't have if you don't have bloodbaths in Vietnam, you blame it on the Khmer Rouge. And you say, well, see, there were bloodbaths.
Yeah.
The communists were that evil. Not home, but somewhere else. And so the two are lumped.
That's true.
And why not? Well, thank you, because actually your answers to that did help. Another question. What was your... Did you have any relationships at all? Or I realize you wanted to keep a distance, but...
There was one Navy... I think sort of Navy... He was either was in... Civic Action. I'm not quite sure whether the Navy called it Civic Action. Mm-hmm. At least he taught a class, I think, at Phan Chu Trinh, and he spoke very good Vietnamese around the IVS house some, and I can't remember his name now. Later, I moved on to the IVS house there and lived with a Vietnamese family.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, I didn't know, so I'd learn more. So after that, I had sort of less, I'd still stop by,
right.
But I didn't have too much world vision, but like that.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't world vision. And he was involved in some projects at the hospital, which was, this house was right across the street from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a nice guy.
That's okay.
It'll come to me. But it was a kind of church-affiliated volunteer organization that was doing work with what we call the other... I didn't have anything to do like with a USAID person or anyone. Mostly it was going to teach at Phan Chu Trinh High School, getting ready for classes, coming back, trying to study a little Vietnamese. I kept, you know, I'd carry around these little slips of paper with Vietnamese vocabulary stuffed in my pocket, and I'd spend a lot of time with that. But we taught fairly consistently, you know, and fairly... I don't know, you know, we weren't overworked, but then I remember I coached a little basketball team there, set up a basketball team, and would sort of work with them a little bit.
Did you have an English class?
But they were big classes, so, you know, if you give any kind of written work, you'd be working with it forever.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much full-time teaching, basically.
When you had a two-year commitment,
yeah.
And at the end of the 2 years...
Oh, 1 year in Da Nang,
one
and then
Da Nang.
I spent my second year in Hue.
Okay, how did you feel about that transition?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah,
I mean, I loved Hue.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you... Have you been to Da Nang?
No, I've been there, but not to Hue.
Not to Hue?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's different. It's night and day. They're different cities. It would be kind of like, I don't know, partly moving from maybe from... Indiana to San Francisco or something, and it's not that Da Nang is all that was all that heavily industrialized, but it was part is they're different cities to start with. Hue is a more cultural kind of place. It's where they lived, and there's a university there, and it's a smaller town than Da Nang. It's a very beautiful town because the Perfume River comes right. And then the Trung Shan Mountains are in the distance, and it's just absolutely bitter. And then the fact that they didn't build any military bases there means that the American presence was greatly reduced. And so your chances of having a kind of, you know, sort of make friends and having, carving out a separate niche for yourself were much greater. So I just loved it. I loved the change. I was very glad to leave Da Nang. reminded of the war and the American presence, overwhelming American presence every day. Mm-hmm. What we were trying to do, you know, was we were trying to sort of work at our turn. I went up early in the summer and helped them catalog books in the university library according to the decimal system. Mm-hmm. That was an interesting job. That, hey, Vaughn, how you doing?
So I'll find you a card in case you got one.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take a little break here for a second.
Hey, Casey.
Hi. Have you heard?
We'll pick up.
One of my monthly reports to IVS on the library, so I can give you my report.
Well, they're really frightening now. I mean, to see students working as hard as they are in Vietnam in those tiny libraries, the history and the literature, it might get better. It's one thing that can get better. So. Yeah. But anyway, I was going to ask you about your experience with the library.
Experience in the library, yeah. Well, we were cataloging books, and I remember I had to learn the Dewey Decimal System. You know, they had books on it, but it didn't take me too long. And then this worker, an older man, would bring books, this pile of books to me, and so I sort of struck up a friendship with him.
Yeah.
I remember him saying it, you know, it's just, you know, this is a useless activity. I must have thought did occur to me, you know, so this war's going on, and here I'm cataloging these endless piles of books in English that, you know, I wondered whether anyone would ever read. But anyway, I said, well, why? And he said, well, they'll come back. You know, they'll be back. And it was sort of that feeling of concern because, of course, Hue was the city where they did come in and take over the city. Mm-hmm. And that actual library was one of the places of refuge. And they were burning books there to get so they could cook rice during the Tet Offensive. A real fear that things hadn't been settled and that which made development so difficult. There was this sort of feeling that they hadn't been resolved. And it was clear to anyone that the situation was not resolved. I mean, that's putting it mildly, right? The situation was not resolved. I mean, there's a war going on. So it made it very, very difficult to be engaged in anything. You had this sort of sense that a whole lot of effort would only be futile. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think the Vietnamese had that feeling, and I had that feeling to a certain extent. But anyway, I went ahead and cataloged. And then I lived above the library, which was, it was the Bank d'Indochine. It was the way So I had, and there was this big, you know, sort of French ceiling fan in this room. And it was, I sort of had this feeling that I was sort of, it was too much of a feeling, and I was replacing some sort of French colonialist who sat under that same French ceiling fan.
Go tell the Spartans.
So I kind of had that feeling, but it was a great building. It was, and I had a room with, with Dick Grisham, who came as a newer volunteer there, and David Borcant, who later committed suicide. Actually, I can show it to you. I reread my sort of remarks. I a little bit about him after he died for the IVS reporter. Uh-huh. He had been in the army and had learned Vietnamese, so he came into IVS speaking very already quote from Kim Van Gu. I mean, he really knew his stuff. He'd studied Vietnamese at Yale too, but he was someone his or really just sort of tore him apart. And the mission of the war and his parents' divorce kind of just put him in a kind of a depressive state. And
but David Borcant,
Borquin, I think. Yeah. American. Yeah, he was American, but he'd been born in Switzerland.
Right.
And he spoke French. Excellent. But anyway. The library was my first home in Hue, and it worked all right. I got to know some of the families that lived behind the library, and most of them worked for the university in some capacity. Teaching was like a lot of teaching, as you say. You probably heard stories about that already.
Well, the long tables, the 60 students, you know, the lack of textbooks. But you had a little bit better at the university.
A little bit better, and maybe a little smaller classes than 60. Mm-hmm. And, well, students in the English section. I taught at the Faculty of Pedagogy and the Faculty of Letters, mm-hmm. and they were wonderful students, really. I mean, they were so interested in learning, and they were so, I don't think I've ever had students quite like them in terms of their interest, motivation. And I often think, though, that I was trying to think what the percentage of those students, many of them are in San Jose.
Yes.
And many are in Southern California. I wonder why. I mean, obviously you're exaggerating because you meet a few and you think it's a whole lot.
Right.
But I many, many of those students are in this country.
Why do you think that's the case? I mean, it's
Because studying English was a political act to a certain extent. Majoring it, not studying it in high school, but majoring in it in college. Mm-hmm. Meant you would, the more radical students would probably be majoring in Vietnamese literature, you know, or something else. Mm-hmm. Putting your political allegiances by deciding to study English. And of course, if you know English, then you're more exposed to Western ways of thinking, so you're more confident about being able to make it in America, so you're more likely to take the risk to be a boat person, and you're probably more frustrated with the way things are being run, because you've had this vision of other ways of doing things, I think. And probably maybe your parents, too, you see, have been involved in some way, because Americans are with the West, so therefore that's why you're studying English, you know, so those connections would affect you. Those are probably the reasons.
Well, let me float a really loaded question in here. I was talking to one IVSer, and said, she said, you know the Vietnamese who are in the United States? Mm-hmm. And had worked, by the way, very hard.
Oh, I can't.
Oh, good.
Can't.
No, it's all right.
I can't accept that view. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, people were caught in the middle of this war, and you have to lead your life. Mm-hmm. And you have to make decisions, and you make them as you go along. But to paint with one brush, the people, and many of these people were committed to the values that we should be committed to, that I'm committed to, in terms of a certain amount of freedom to pursue what you want to pursue. No one embodied some of those values better than the rector, president. They called it rectors. Were people who believed in some of the things that Americans say they believe in, and they were working to try to achieve them. Mm-hmm. And I can't, you know, I also respect people who chose to, you know, become revolutionaries and join the other side. I understand, I see their viewpoint too, but I think people have to make their choices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the terrible thing is the options for this middle group, the group that didn't like the Saigon regime, and most people didn't, you know, there was no place in the middle to go. Mm-hmm. So, I honor the choices that those students made, and they were wonderful people, and some of them are still my best friends. Right. So,
well, actually, I wasn't talking about those individuals. Yeah. I mean, I'm not talking about any of them.
Yeah.
But this IVSer, I think, was remarking, when you look at the San Jose elite, and you know that this anger that so many of the grassroots people had to be left behind, and they had no options because of their political status.
Well, that's particularly true. And I think, of course, a lot of the people who were able to get out so easily, there were many military people in the military, and I think there are some sort of rightist groups of military veterans who are politically quite active, and to go back to Vietnam for fear that just traveling back would be perceived by these rightist groups as a sort of sign of allegiance to the communist government, and they were fearful that they might be threatened in some way.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, I'm sure some IVS volunteers who live in San Jose know more about that community than I do. May have some.
Yes, I think that comment really, that it was essentially that that person had identified with a kind of grassroots.
And that's true. And maybe some of these were the ag people. You have to understand,
right.
I was dealing with an elite group.
Right. You in particular.
In Hue, particularly.
In Hue at the university.
In Hue at
yes.
the university.
Yes.
Not in Da Nang so much, although there's a sense in which even the high school students in Da Nang were an elite group. It was a little more widespread. But in Hue, definitely, this was a group of really pretty well-off people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gives us a perspective on that issue. That's very useful.
Yeah.
And
ended
for IVS.
For IVS, mm-hmm. yeah. It ended, I guess, must have been around June of 70.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came, and I actually worked in the IVS office for a year. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, first I worked for this guy, our former governor of Vermont, badly.
Uh-huh.
But, and then after that election was over in November, I went down to...
But then was the program over in Vietnam?
The program, no, it hadn't, it didn't,
not
it
yet.
Ended during my year at home.
Uh-huh.
And I was around the head, and they dragged me into some TV show, wanted to move to IBS, and why I thought, why we were leaving, and, you know, some of the problems and so forth.
Uh-huh.
I was the only one around to do it, so
uh-huh.
I got that job.
And you did it?
Oh, I did it. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Do you remember what state? What?
I don't remember what station.
That is your job. Find out because they. I'm no. They have. They'll have it. If it went on the air, it's still there.
Well, it was on the air.
Yeah.
But it was a short little 3-4 minutes. You know, they had a whole lot of topics, and this was a kind.
Oh yes, but when we talk about the death of IVS, we have lots of one. I mean, we only have thus far a couple of very good stories. The best one was. I believe it was Mark Lynch.
Mark Lynch was
jumped all over Richard Peters when he came to Saigon to try. Richard hit Mark. He hit him with his. Embarrassed about it later, but it showed. He said it gives you an idea of the pressure and the problems and the intensity of the emotions around the program and about the war. That's why having that tape that you did. Will kind of give us a good idea.
Gee,
of
it would
all
be.
That.
I wish I could.
Yeah.
Maybe I
know about the IVS records.
You never know about the IVS records.
Because they did some
records.
House cleaning a while back.
Yes, I know they
might
did.
Not be there.
I know they did. But anyway, then I went back later with the Fulbright program, and it's been in some ways during that later period. Of course, that's when I met Quinn, and
your wife,
my wife, and that's when, you know, I was there for the Easter Offensive. When the refugees poured in from Quang Tri and thought they were coming all the way. That in some ways was a kind of affected me more deeply than some of my early years, even with IVS in some ways, because a lot of things were happening personally and then regard that whole offensive was such a... And my Vietnamese was a little better at that point, too. So I could... I felt, and I'd been there longer. You know, by the time I'd been 3 years, 4 years in the country, and 3 years in Hue. By the time I finally left, although some of that last year was spent, well, you know, the university closed down and was a little slow in opening up after the offensive.
Actually, leave Vietnam.
So I left finally in the end of 73. It was the end of. I left before the sort of final.
Right, and Quinn's family, what happened in 75?
In 75, most of Quinn's family were teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, her two brothers were teachers. One brother was in France, who'd gone to France earlier. And they, you know, they're still teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't, you know, no sort of re-education camp experience, or they were spared that because they weren't in... involved. Their only sort of involvement with the Americans was one daughter married to an
American. Yes.
But there were no sort of reprisals or hard economically, but they did have like a lot of families who had people abroad. I mean, California and then a daughter, Susan Hue. I went back in 92 on a research trip, it was before Quinn's father died, so it was a very moving trip after 17 years to go back and to see them again in Hue, and moving experience is like one time walking a long way and this former student comes by and sort of slows his motorcycle up and it's this Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer. Uh-huh. It was just terribly moving. Unfortunately, I was in a sort of semi-official kind of research trip. Mm-hmm. There was someone from that office traveling with me, and so everything was kind of official, and there was some suspicion of whether, you know, my role.
And in 92, you'd be followed
in
anyway.
In 92, I'd be followed anyway. It wasn't quite as open as it is now. Mm-hmm. So it took me a long time to get permission to go to Hawaii, so by the time I got done, I only had 3 days there, and it was a little abbreviated, but it was just to be back in that city where so much had happened to me and to Quinn and to Quinn and me. Parents again, and just to see that some people, my nieces and nephews, mm-hmm. who, you know, are sort of so focused on the future, mm-hmm. which as they should be. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, I think it was good to go back because you think sort of you have this sort of, in your mind, the place is still 1972, mm-hmm. 3, mm-hmm. but of course life goes on mm-hmm. and the world moves on, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it was a wonderful experience. Another wonderful experience was my student to go teach at a Hawaii high school, and one of the teachers was a former student of mine. Uh-huh. So it's kind of this generational thing. It was uh-huh. kind of wonderful that he went back to do a little English teaching, and the teacher was actually a former student of mine. So not all my students are in San Jose.
But the other thing is, it's also an indication of the degree of success
yes.
of your work.
Yes, uh-huh. yes. It's very, yeah, that's what's nice now that the war recedes. Some of the personal friendships that have been made are sort of, in a sense, highlighted and can take center stage, which is... I think really nice. I want to go back again.